were her fellow and a resident. Emma was only a few years older than I, her hair long and dark, but as is common to all those who spend time with death, streaked with gray. She pulled up a chair.
"Hi, my name is Emma," she said. "I'm sorry to have to be so brief today, but I wanted to come by and introduce myself."
We shook hands, my arm entangled in the IV line.
"Thanks for stopping by," I said. "I know you have kids to pick up. This is my family."
She nodded hello at Lucy, at my brothers and parents.
"I'm sorry this is happening to you," she said. "To all of you. There will be a lot of time to talk in a couple days.
I went ahead and had the lab start running some tests on your tumor sample, which will help guide therapy. Treatment may be chemotherapy or not, depending on the tests." 18 months earlier, I'd been in the hospital with appendicitis. Then I'd been treated not as a patient, but as a colleague, almost like a consultant on my own case. I expected the same here.
"I know now's not the time," I proceeded, "but I will want to talk about the Kaplan-Meier survival curves."
"No," she said, "absolutely not." A brief silence.
"How dare she?" I thought. "This is how doctors like me, understand prognostication. I have a right to know." "We can talk about therapies later," she said. "We can talk about your going back to work, too, if that's what you'd like to do.
The traditional chemotherapy combination, cisplatin, pemetrexed, possibly with Avastin, too, has a high rate of peripheral neuropathy, so we'd probably switch the cisplatin for carboplatin, which will protect your nerves better since you're a surgeon."
Go back to work? What is she talking about? Is she delusional? Or am I dead wrong about my prognosis? And how can we talk about any of this without a realistic estimate of survival?
The ground, having already buckled and roiled over the past few days, did so again.
"We can do details later," she continued, "as I know this is a lot to absorb. Mostly, I just wanted to meet you all before our appointment Thursday. Is there anything I can do or answer, besides survival curves, today?"
"No," I said, my mind reeling. "Thanks so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it."
"Here's my card," she said, "and there's the clinic number. Feel free to call if anything comes up before we see you in 2 days."
My family and friends quickly wired through our network of medical colleagues to find out who the best lung cancer oncologists in the country were. Houston and New York had major cancer centers. Was that where I should be treated? The logistics of moving or temporarily relocating or what have you, that could be sorted out later. The replies came back quickly and more or less unanimously. Emma, not only was one of the best, a world-renowned oncologist who served as the lung cancer expert on one of the major national cancer advisory boards, but she was also known to be compassionate, someone who knew when to push and when to hold back. I briefly wondered at the string of events that had sent me looping through the world. My residency determined by a computerized match process, only to end up assigned here, with a freak diagnosis, in the hands of one of the finest doctors to treat it. Having spent the better part of the week bedridden, with the cancer progressing, I had grown noticeably weaker. My body, and the identity tied to it, had radically changed. No longer was getting in and out of bed to go to the bathroom an automated subcortical motor program. It took effort and planning. The physical therapists left a list of items to ease my transition home. A cane, a modified toilet seat, foam blocks for leg support while resting. A bevy of new pain medications was prescribed. As I hobbled out of the hospital, I wondered how, just 6 days ago, I had spent nearly 36 straight hours in the operating room. Had I grown that much sicker in a week? Yes, in part. But I had also used a number of tricks and help from co-surgeons to get through those 36 hours. And, even so,
I had suffered excruciating pain. Had the confirmation of my fears, in the CT scan, in the lab results, both showing not merely cancer, but a body overwhelmed, nearing death, released me from the duty to serve, from my duty to patients, to neurosurgery, to the pursuit of goodness? Yes, I thought. And therein was the paradox. Like a runner crossing the finish line only to collapse without that duty to care for the ill pushing me forward, I became an invalid. Usually, when I had a patient with a strange condition, I consulted the relevant specialist and spent time reading about it. This seemed no different. But as I started reading about chemo, which included a whole variety of agents, and a raft of more modern, novel treatments that targeted specific mutations, the sheer number of questions I had prevented any useful directed study. Alexander Pope, a little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep, or taste not the Pierian spring. Without appropriate medical experience, I couldn't place myself in this new world of information, couldn't find my spot on the Kaplan-Meier curve. I waited, expectantly, for my clinic visit. But mostly, I rested. I sat, staring at a photo of Lucy and me from medical school, dancing and laughing. It was so sad, those two, planning a life together, unaware, never suspecting their own fragility. My friend Lori had had a fiancé when she died in a car accident. Was this any crueler? My family engaged in a flurry of activity to transform my life from that of a doctor to that of a patient. We set up an account with a mail-order pharmacy, ordered a bed rail, and bought an ergonomic mattress to help alleviate the searing back pain. Our financial plan, which a few days before had banked on my income increasing sixfold in the next year, now looked precarious, and a variety of new financial instruments seemed necessary to protect Lucy. My father declared that these modifications were capitulations to the disease. I was going to beat this thing. I would somehow be cured. How often had I heard a patient's family member make similar declarations? I never knew what to say to them then, and I didn't know what to say to my father now. What was the alternate story? 2 days later, Lucy and I met Emma in the clinic. My parents hovered in the waiting room. The medical assistant took my vitals. Emma and her nurse practitioner were remarkably punctual, and Emma pulled up a chair in front of me to talk face to face, eye to eye. "Hello again," she said. "This is Alexis, my right hand." She gestured to the NP, who sat at the computer taking notes. "I know there's a lot to discuss, but first, how are you doing?" "Okay, all things considered," I said. "Enjoying my vacation, I guess. How are you?" "Oh, I'm okay." She paused. Patients don't typically ask how their doctors are doing, but Emma was also a colleague. "I'm running the inpatient service this week, so you know how that is." She smiled. Lucy and I did, though. Outpatient specialists rotated on the inpatient service periodically, adding several hours of work in an already jam-packed day. After more pleasantries, we settled into a comfortable discussion on the state of lung cancer research. There were two paths forward, she said. The traditional method was chemotherapy, which generically targeted rapidly dividing cells, primarily cancer cells, but also cells in your bone marrow, hair follicles, intestines, and so forth. Emma reviewed the data and options, lecturing as if to another doctor, but again, with the exception of any mention of Kaplan-Meier survival curves. Newer therapies had been developed, however, targeting specific molecular defects in the cancer itself. I had heard rumors of such efforts. It had long been a holy grail in cancer work, and was surprised to learn how much progress had been made. These treatments, it seemed, had led to long-term survival in some patients. "Most of your tests are back," Emma said. You have a PI3K mutation, but no one's sure what that means yet. The test for the most common mutation in patients like you, EGFR, is still pending. I'm betting that's what you have, and if so, there's a pill called Tarceva that you can take instead of chemotherapy. That result should be back tomorrow, Friday, but you're sick enough that I've set you up for chemo starting Monday in case the EGFR test is negative. I immediately felt a kinship. This was exactly how I approached neurosurgery. Have a plan A, B, and C at all times. With chemo, our main decision will be carboplatin versus cisplatin. In isolated studies head-to-head, carboplatin is better tolerated. Cisplatin has potentially better results, but much worse toxicity, especially for the nerves. Though all the data is old, and there's no direct comparison within our modern chemo regimens. Do you have any thoughts? I'm less worried about protecting my hands for surgery, I said. There's a lot I can do with my life. If I lose my hands, I can find another job, or not work, or something. She paused. Let me ask this. Is surgery important to you? Is it something you want to do? Well, yes. I've spent almost a third of my life preparing for it. Okay. Then I'm going to suggest we stick with the carboplatin. I don't think it will change survival, and I do think it could dramatically change your quality of life. Do you have any other questions? She seemed clear that this was the way to go, and I was happy to follow. Maybe, I began to let myself believe, performing surgery again was a possibility. I felt myself relax a little. Can I start smoking? I joked. Lucy laughed, and Emma rolled her eyes. No. Any serious questions? The Kaplan-Meier, we're not discussing that, she said. I didn't understand her resistance. After all, I was a doctor familiar with these statistics. I could look them up myself. So that's what I would have to do. Okay, I said. Then I think everything is pretty clear. We'll hear from you tomorrow about the EGFR results. If yes, then we'll start a pill, Tarceva. If no, then we start chemotherapy, Monday. Right. The other thing I want you to know is this. I am your doctor now. Any problem you have, from primary care to whatever, you come to us first. Again, I felt a pang of kinship. Thanks, I said. And good luck on the inpatient wards. She left the room, only to pop her head back in a second later. Feel free to say no to this, but there are some lung cancer fundraisers who would love to meet you. Don't answer now, think about it, and let Alexis know if you might be interested. Don't do anything you don't want to. As we left, Lucy remarked, She's great. She's a good fit for you. Although, she smiled, I think she likes you.
And?
Well, there's that study that says doctors do a worse job prognosticating for patients they're personally invested in.
On our list of things to worry about, I said, with a laugh, I think that's in the bottom quartile.
I began to realize that coming in such close contact with my own mortality had changed both nothing and everything. Before my cancer was diagnosed, I knew that someday I would die, but I didn't know when. After the diagnosis, I knew that someday I would die, but I didn't know when. But now, I knew it acutely. The problem wasn't really a scientific one. The fact of death is unsettling, yet there is no other way to live. Slowly, the medical fog was clearing. At least now I had enough information to dive into the literature. While the numbers were fuzzy, having an EGFR mutation seemed to add around a year of life on average, with the potential for long-term survival. Not having it suggested an 80% chance of death within 2 years. Clarifying the rest of my life was going to be a process. The next day, Lucy and I went to the sperm bank to preserve gametes and options. We had always planned to have kids at the end of my residency, but now... The cancer drugs would have an unknown effect on my sperm, so to keep a chance of having children, we'd have to freeze sperm before I started treatment. A young woman walked us through a variety of payment plans and options for storage and legal forms for ownership. On her desk were a multitude of colorful pamphlets about various social outings for young people with cancer. Improv groups, a cappella groups, open mic nights, and so on. I envied their happy faces, knowing that, statistically, they all probably had highly treatable forms of cancer and reasonable life expectancies. Only 0.0012% of 36-year-olds get lung cancer. Yes, all cancer patients are unlucky, but there's cancer, and then there's cancer. Then you have to be really unlucky to have the latter. When she asked us to specify what would happen to the sperm if one of us were to die, who would legally own them in the event of death? Tears began rolling down Lucy's face. The word hope first appeared in English about 1,000 years ago, denoting some combination of confidence and desire. But what I desired, life, was not what I was confident about. Death. When I talked about hope then, did I really mean leave some room for unfounded desire? No. Medical statistics not only describe numbers such as mean survival, they measure our confidence in our numbers, with tools like confidence levels, confidence intervals, and confidence bounds. So, did I mean leave some room for a statistically improbable but still plausible outcome, a survival just above the measured 95% confidence interval? Is that what hope was? Could we divide the curve into existential sections, from defeated to pessimistic to realistic to hopeful to delusional? Weren't the numbers just the numbers? Had we all just given in to the hope that every patient was above average? It occurred to me that my relationship with statistics changed as soon as I became one. During my residency, I had sat with countless patients and families to discuss grim prognoses. It's one of the most important jobs you have as a physician. It's easier when the patient is 94, in the last stages of dementia, with a severe brain bleed. But for someone like me, a 36-year-old given a diagnosis of terminal cancer, there aren't really words. The reason doctors don't give patients specific prognoses is not merely because they cannot. Certainly, if a patient's expectations are way out of the bounds of probability, someone expecting to live to 130, say, or someone thinking his benign skin spots are signs of imminent death, doctors are entrusted to bring that person's expectations into the realm of reasonable possibility. What patients seek is not scientific knowledge that doctors hide, but existential authenticity each person must find on her own. Getting too deeply into statistics is like trying to quench a thirst with salty water. The angst of facing mortality has no remedy in probability. When we arrived home from the sperm bank, I got a phone call saying that I did, in fact, have a treatable mutation, EGFR. Chemo was off, thankfully, and Tarceva, a little white pill, became my treatment. I soon began to feel stronger, and even though I no longer really knew what it was, I felt it. A drop of hope. The fog surrounding my life rolled back another inch, and a sliver of blue sky peeked through. In the weeks that followed, my appetite returned. I put on a little weight. I developed the characteristic severe acne that correlates with a good response. Lucy had always loved my smooth skin, but now it was pockmarked and, with my blood thinners, constantly bleeding. Any part of me that identified with being handsome was slowly being erased, though, in fairness, I was happy to be uglier and alive. Lucy said she loved my skin just the same, acne and all. But while I knew that our identities derived not just from the brain, I was living its embodied nature. The man who loved hiking, camping, and running, who expressed his love through gigantic hugs, who threw his giggling niece high in the air. That was a man I no longer was. At best, I could aim to be him again. At our first of several bi-weekly appointments, Emma's and my discussion tended from the medical, how's the rash, to the more existential. The traditional cancer narrative, that one ought to recede, spend time with family, and settle one's toes in the peat, was one option. Many people, once diagnosed, quit work entirely, she said. Others focus on it heavily. Either way is okay. I had mapped out this whole 40-year career for myself, the first 20 as a surgeon scientist, the last 20 as a writer. But now that I am likely well into my last 20 years, I don't know which career I should be pursuing.
Well, I can't tell you that, she said. I can only say that you can get back to surgery if you want, but you have to figure out what's most important to you.
If I had some sense of how much time I have left, it'd be easier. If I had 2 years, I'd write. If I had 10, I'd get back to surgery and science.
You know I can't give you a number.
Yes, I knew. It was up to me to quote her oft-repeated refrain, define my values. Part of me felt this was a cop-out. Okay, fine, I never gave out specific numbers to patients either, but didn't I always have a sense of how the patient would do? How else did I make life and death decisions? Then I recalled the times I had been wrong. The time I had counseled a family to withdraw life support for their son, only for the parents to appear 2 years later, showing me a YouTube video of him playing piano and delivering cupcakes and thanks for saving his life. My oncology appointments were the most important of many new appointments with a variety of healthcare providers, but they weren't the only ones. At Lucy's insistence, we began seeing a couples therapist who specialized in cancer patients. Sitting in her windowless office, in side-by-side armchairs, Lucy and I detailed the ways in which our lives, present and future, had been fractured by my diagnosis, and the pain of knowing and not knowing the future, the difficulty in planning, the necessity of being there for each other. In truth, cancer had helped save our marriage.
Well, you two are coping with this better than any couple I've seen, the therapist said at the end of our first session. I'm not sure I have any advice for you.
I laughed as we walked out. At least I was excelling at something again. The years of ministering to terminally ill patients had borne some fruit. I turned to Lucy, expecting to see a smile. Instead, she was shaking her head.
Don't you get it? She said, taking my hand in hers. If we're the best at this, that means it doesn't get better than this.
If the weight of mortality does not grow lighter, does it at least get more familiar? Once I had been diagnosed with a terminal illness, I began to view the world through two perspectives. I was starting to see death as both doctor and patient. As a doctor, I knew not to declare, "Cancer is a battle I'm going to win," or ask, "Why me?" Answer, "Why not me?" I knew a lot about medical care, complications, and treatment algorithms. I quickly learned from my oncologist and my own study that stage 4 lung cancer today was a disease whose story might be changing, like AIDS in the late 1980s. Still a rapidly fatal illness, but with emerging therapies that were, for the first time, providing years of life. While being trained as a physician and scientist had helped me process the data and accept the limits of what that data could reveal about my prognosis, it didn't help me as a patient. It didn't tell Lucy and me whether we should go ahead and have a child, or what it meant to nurture a new life while mine faded. Nor did it tell me whether to fight for my career, to reclaim the ambitions I had single-mindedly pursued for so long, but without the surety of the time to complete them. Like my own patients, I had to face my mortality and try to understand what made my life worth living, and I needed Emma's help to do so. Torn between being a doctor and being a patient, delving into medical science and turning back to literature for answers, I struggled, while facing my own death, to rebuild my old life, or perhaps find a new one. The bulk of my week was spent not in cognitive therapy, but in physical therapy. I had sent nearly every one of my patients to physical therapy, and now I found myself shocked at how difficult it was. As a doctor, you have a sense of what it's like to be sick, but until you've gone through it yourself, you don't really know. It's like falling in love or having a kid. You don't appreciate the mounds of paperwork that come along with it, or the little things. When you get an IV placed, for example, you can actually taste the salt when they start infusing it. They tell me that this happens to everybody, but even after 11 years in medicine, I had never known. In physical therapy, I was not even lifting weights yet, just lifting my legs. This was exhausting and humiliating. My brain was fine, but I did not feel like myself. My body was frail and weak. The person who could run half marathons was a distant memory, and that, too, shapes your identity. Racking back pain can mold an identity. Fatigue and nausea can as well. Karen, my PT, asked me what my goals were. I picked two, riding my bike and going for a run. In the face of weakness, determination set in. Day after day, I kept at it, and every tiny increase in strength broadened the possible worlds, the possible versions of me. I started adding reps, weights, and minutes to my workouts, pushing myself to the point of vomiting. After 2 months, I could sit for 30 minutes without tiring. I could start going to dinner with friends again. One afternoon, Lucy and I drove down to Cañada Road, our favorite biking spot. Usually we would bike there, pride forces me to add, but the hills were still too formidable for my lightweight frame. I managed 6 wobbly miles. It was a far cry from the breezy 30-mile rides of the previous summer, but at least I could balance on 2 wheels. Was this a victory or a defeat? I began to look forward to my meetings with Emma. In her office, I felt like myself, like a self. Outside her office, I no longer knew who I was. Because I wasn't working, I didn't feel like myself, a neurosurgeon, a scientist, a young man, relatively speaking, with a bright future spread before him. Debilitated, at home, I feared I wasn't much of a husband for Lucy. I had passed from the subject to the direct object of every sentence of my life. In 14th century philosophy, the word patient simply meant the object of an action, and I felt like one. As a doctor, I was an agent, a cause. As a patient, I was merely something to which things happened. But in Emma's office, Lucy and I could joke, trade doctor lingo, talk freely about our hopes and dreams, try to assemble a plan to move forward. 2 months in, Emma remained vague about any prognostication, and every statistic I cited, she rebuffed with a reminder to focus on my values. Though I felt dissatisfied, at least I felt like somebody, a person, rather than a thing exemplifying the second law of thermodynamics. All order tends toward entropy, decay, etc. Flush in the face of mortality, many decisions became compressed, urgent, and unreceding. Foremost among them for us, should Lucy and I have a child? Even if our marriage had been strained toward the end of my residency, we had always remained very much in love, Our relationship was still deep in meaning, a shared and evolving vocabulary about what mattered. If human relationality formed the bedrock of meaning, it seemed to us that rearing children added another dimension to that meaning. It had been something we'd always wanted, and we were both impelled by the instinct to do it still, to add another chair to our family's table. Both of us yearning to be parents, we each thought of the other. Lucy hoped I had years left, but understanding my prognosis, she felt that the choice, whether to spend my remaining time as a father, should be mine. "What are you most afraid or sad about?" she asked me one night as we were lying in bed. "Leaving you," I told her. I knew a child would bring joy to the whole family, and I couldn't bear to picture Lucy husbandless and childless after I died. But I was adamant that the decision ultimately be hers. She would likely have to raise the child on her own, after all, and to care for both of us as my illness progressed. "Will having a newborn distract from the time we have together?" she asked. "Don't you think saying goodbye to your child will make your death more painful?"
"Wouldn't it be great if it did?" I said.
Lucy and I both felt that life wasn't about avoiding suffering. Years ago, it had occurred to me that Darwin and Nietzsche agreed on one thing: the defining characteristic of the organism is striving. Describing life otherwise was like painting a tiger without stripes. After so many years of living with death, I'd come to understand that the easiest death wasn't necessarily the best. We talked it over. Our families gave their blessing. We decided to have a child. We would carry on living instead of dying. Because of the medications I was on, assisted reproduction appeared to be the only route forward. So we visited a specialist at a reproductive endocrinology clinic in Palo Alto. She was efficient and professional, but her lack of experience dealing with terminally ill, as opposed to infertile patients, was obvious. She plowed through her spiel, eyes on her clipboard. "How long have you been trying?"
"Well, we haven't yet."
"Oh, right. Of course." Finally, she asked, "Given your, situation, I assume you want to get pregnant fast?"
"Yes," Lucy said. "We'd like to start right away."
"I'd suggest you begin with IVF then," she said. When I mentioned that we'd rather minimize how many embryos were created and destroyed, she looked slightly confused. Most people who came here prized expedience above all. But I was determined to avoid the situation where, after I died, Lucy had responsibility for a half dozen embryos, the last remnants of our shared genomes, my last presence on this earth, stuck in a freezer somewhere, too painful to destroy, impossible to bring to full humanity. Technological artifacts that no one knew how to relate to. But after several trials of intrauterine insemination, it was clear we needed a higher level of technology. We would need to create at least a few embryos in vitro and implant the healthiest. The others would die. Even in having children in this new life, death played its part. 6 weeks after starting treatment, I was due for my first CT scan to measure the efficacy of the Tarceva. As I hopped out of the scanner, the CT tech looked at me. "Well, Doc," he offered, "I'm not supposed to say this, but there's a computer back there if you want to take a look." I loaded up the images on the viewer, typing in my own name. The acne was a reassuring sign. My strength had also improved, though I was still limited by back pain and fatigue. Sitting there, I reminded myself of what Emma had said. Even a small amount of tumor growth, so long as it was small, would be considered a success. My father, of course, had predicted that all the cancer would be gone. "Your scan will be clear, puppy," he'd declared, using my family nickname. I repeated to myself that even small growth was good news.
took a breath, and clicked. The images materialized on the screen. My lungs, speckled with innumerable tumors before, were clear, except for a 1 centimeter nodule in the right upper lobe. I could make out my spine beginning to heal. There had been a clear, dramatic reduction in tumor burden. Relief washed over me. My cancer was stable. When we met Emma the next day, she still refused to talk prognosis, but she said, "You're well enough that we can meet every 6 weeks now. Next time we meet, we can start to talk about what your life might be like." I could feel the chaos of the past months receding, a sense of a new order settling in. My contracted sense of the future began to relax. A local meeting of former Stanford neurosurgery graduates was happening that weekend, and I looked forward to the chance to reconnect with my former self. Yet being there merely heightened the surreal contrast of what my life was now. I was surrounded by success and possibility and ambition, by peers and seniors whose lives were running along a trajectory that was no longer mine, whose bodies could still tolerate standing for a grueling 8-hour surgery. I felt trapped inside a reversed Christmas carol. Victoria was opening the happy present. Grants, job offers, publications. I should be sharing. My senior peers were living the future that was no longer mine. Early career awards, promotions, new houses. No one asked about my plans, which was a relief, since I had none. While I could now walk without a cane, a paralytic uncertainty loomed. Who would I be going forward? And for how long? Invalid? Scientist? Teacher? Bioethicist? Neurosurgeon once again, as Emma had implied? Stay-at-home dad? Writer? Who could or should I be? As a doctor, I had had some sense of what patients with life-changing illnesses faced, and it was exactly these moments I had wanted to explore with them. Shouldn't terminal illness, then, be the perfect gift to that young man who had wanted to understand death? What better way to understand it than to live it? But I'd had no idea how hard it would be, how much terrain I would have to explore, map, settle. I'd always imagined the doctor's work as something like connecting 2 pieces of railroad track, allowing a smooth journey for the patient. I hadn't expected the prospect of facing my own mortality to be so disorienting, so dislocating. I thought back to my younger self, who might have wanted to forge in the smithy of my soul the uncreated conscience of my race. Looking into my own soul, I found the tools too brittle, the fire too weak to forge even my own conscience. Lost in a featureless wasteland of my own mortality, and finding no traction in the reams of scientific studies, intracellular molecular pathways, and endless curves of survival statistics, I began reading literature again. Solzhenitsyn's Cancer Ward, B.S. Johnson's The Unfortunates, Tolstoy's Ivan Ilyich, Nagel's Mind and Cosmos, Wolf, Kafka, Montaigne, Frost, Greville, Memoirs of Cancer Patients, anything by anyone who had ever written about mortality. I was searching for a vocabulary with which to make sense of death, to find a way to begin defining myself and inching forward again. The privilege of direct experience had led me away from literary and academic work. Yet now, I felt that to understand my own direct experiences, I would have to translate them back into language. Hemingway described his process in similar terms, acquiring rich experiences, then retreating to cogitate and write about them. I needed words to go forward. And so it was literature that brought me back to life during this time. The monolithic uncertainty of my future was deadening. Everywhere I turned, the shadow of death obscured the meaning of any action.
I remember the moment when my overwhelming unease yielded, when that seemingly impassable sea of uncertainty parted. I woke up in pain, facing another day. No project beyond breakfast seemed tenable. I can't go on, I thought. And immediately its antiphon responded, completing Samuel Beckett's 7 words, words I had learned long ago as an undergraduate. I'll go on. I got out of bed and took a step forward, repeating the phrase over and over. I can't go on. I'll go on. That morning, I made a decision. I would push myself to return to the OR. Why? Because I could. Because that's who I was. Because I would have to learn to live in a different way, seeing death as an imposing itinerant visitor, but knowing that even if I'm dying, until I actually die, I am still living. Over the next 6 weeks, I altered my physical therapy program, focusing now on building strength specifically for operating. Long hours of standing, micromanipulation of small objects, pronation for placing pedicle screws. Another CT scan followed. The tumor had shrunk slightly more. Going over the images with me, Emma said, "I don't know how long you've got, but I will say this. The patient I saw just before you today has been on Tarceva for 7 years without a problem. You've still got a ways to go before we're that comfortable with your cancer, but looking at you, thinking about living 10 years is not crazy. You might not make it, but it's not crazy." Here was the prognostication. No, not prognostication. Justification. Justification of my decision to return to neurosurgery, to return to life. One part of me exulted at the prospect of 10 years. Another part wished she'd said, "Going back to being a neurosurgeon is crazy for you. Pick something easier." I was startled to realize that in spite of everything, the last few months had had one area of lightness, not having to bear the tremendous weight of the responsibility neurosurgery demanded, and part of me wanted to be excused from picking up the yoke again. Neurosurgery is really hard work, and no one would have faulted me for not going back. People often ask if it is a calling, and my answer is always yes. You can't see it as a job, because if it's a job, it's one of the worst jobs there is. A couple of my professors actively discouraged the idea. "Shouldn't you be spending time with your family?" "Shouldn't you?" I wondered. I was making the decision to do this work because this work, to me, was a sacred thing. Lucy and I had just reached the top of the hill, the landmarks of Silicon Valley, buildings bearing the names of every biomedical and technological transformation of the last generation unfolding below us. Eventually, though, the itch to hold a surgical drill again had become too compelling. Moral duty has weight. Things that have weight have gravity. And so the duty to bear mortal responsibility pulled me back into the operating room. Lucy was fully supportive. I called up the program director to tell him I was ready to return. He was thrilled. Victoria and I talked about how best to reintroduce me and get me back up to speed. I requested that a fellow resident be available to back me up at all times in case something went awry. Furthermore, I would do only one case per day. I wouldn't manage the patients outside the OR or be on call. We'd proceed conservatively. The OR schedule came out, and I was assigned to a temporal lobectomy, one of my favorite operations. Commonly, epilepsy is caused by a misfiring hippocampus, which is located deep in the temporal lobe. Removing the hippocampus can cure the epilepsy, but the operation is complex, requiring gentle dissection of the hippocampus off the pia, the delicate transparent covering of the brain right near the brainstem. I spent the night prior poring through surgical textbooks, reviewing the anatomy and steps of the operation. I slept restlessly, seeing the angle of the head, the saw against the skull, the way the light reflects off the pia once the temporal lobe is removed. I got out of bed and put on a shirt and tie. I had returned all my scrubs months ago, assuming I'd never need them again. I arrived at the hospital and changed into the familiar blue garb for the first time in 18 weeks. I chatted with the patient to make sure there were no last-minute questions, then began the process of setting up the OR. The patient was intubated. The attending and I were scrubbed and ready to begin. I picked up the scalpel and incised the skin just above the ear, proceeding slowly, trying to make sure I forgot nothing and made no mistakes. With the electrocautery, I deepened the incision to the bone, then elevated the skin flap with hooks. Everything felt familiar, muscle memory kicking in. I took the drill and made 3 holes in the skull. The attending squirted water to keep the drill cool as I worked. Switching to the craniotome, a sideways cutting drill bit, I connected the holes, freeing up a large piece of bone. With a crack, I pried it off. There lay the silvery dura. Happily, I hadn't damaged it with the drill, a common beginner's mistake. I used a sharp knife to open the dura without injuring the brain. Success again. I began to relax. I tacked back the dura with small stitches to keep it out of the way of the main surgery. The brain gently pulsed and glistened. The huge Sylvian veins ran across the top of the temporal lobe, pristine. The familiar peach convolutions of the brain beckoned. Suddenly, the edges of my vision dimmed. I put down my instruments and stepped back from the table. The blackness encroached farther as a feeling of lightness overcame me. "Sorry, sir," I told the attending. "I'm feeling a little faint. I think I need to lie down. Jack, my junior resident, will finish the case." Jack arrived quickly, and I excused myself. I sipped some orange juice in the lounge, lying on the couch. After 20 minutes, I began to feel better. "Neurocardiogenic syncope," I whispered to myself. "The autonomic nervous system briefly shutting down the heart. Or, as it's more commonly known, a case of the nerves. A rookie problem." This was not how I'd envisioned my return to the OR. I went to the locker room, threw my dirty scrubs in the laundry, and put on my civilian clothes. On the way out, I grabbed a stack of clean scrubs. Tomorrow, I told myself, would be a better day. It was. Every day, each case felt familiar, but moved a little more slowly. On day 3, I was removing a degenerated disc from a patient's spine. I stared at the bulging disc, not remembering my exact move. The fellow supervising me suggested taking small bites with a rongeur. "Yeah, I know that's how it's usually done," I mumbled. "But there's another way." I nibbled away for 20 minutes, my brain searching for the more elegant way I had learned to do this. At the next spinal level, it came back to me in a flash. "Cobb instrument," I called out. "Mallet, kerosene." I had the whole disc removed in 30 seconds. "That's how I do this," I said. Over the next couple of weeks, my strength continued to improve, as did my fluency and technique. My hands relearned how to manipulate submillimeter blood vessels without injury, my fingers conjuring up the old tricks they'd once known. After a month, I was operating a nearly full load. I kept myself limited to operating, leaving the administration, patient care, and night and weekend calls to Victoria and the other senior residents. I had already mastered those skills anyway, and needed to learn only the nuances of complex operations to feel complete. I ended my days exhausted beyond measure, muscles on fire, slowly improving. But the truth was, it was joyless. The visceral pleasure I'd once found in operating was gone, replaced by an iron focus on overcoming the nausea, the pain, the fatigue. Coming home each night,
I would scarf down a handful of pain pills, then crawl into bed next to Lucy, who had returned to a full work schedule as well. She was now in the first trimester of pregnancy, with the baby due in June, when I would complete residency. We had a photo of our child as a blastocyst, taken just before implantation. "She has your cell membrane," I remarked to Lucy. Still, I was determined to restore my life to its prior trajectory. Another stable scan 6 months after diagnosis passed, and I reopened my job search. With my cancer under control, I might have several years left. It seemed the career I had worked for years to attain, which had disappeared amid disease, was now back in reach. I could almost hear trumpets sounding a victory fanfare. During my next visit with Emma, we talked about life and where it was taking me. I recalled Henry Adams trying to compare the scientific force of the combustion engine and the existential force of the Virgin Mary. The scientific questions were settled for now, allowing the existential ones full play. Yet both were in the doctor's purview. I had recently learned that the surgeon-scientist position at Stanford, the job for which I had been heir apparent, had been filled while I was out sick. I was crushed, and told her so. "Well," she said, "this doctor-professor thing can be a real grind, but you know that already. I'm sorry." "Yeah, I guess the science that excited me was about 20-year projects. Without that kind of time frame, I'm not sure I'm all that interested in being a scientist." I tried to console myself. "You can't get much done in a couple of years." "Right. And just remember, you're doing great. You're working again, you've got a baby on the way. You're finding your values, and that's not easy." Later that day, one of the younger professors, a former resident and close friend, stopped me in the hallway. "Hey," she said, "there's been a lot of discussion in faculty meetings about what to do with you."
"What to do with me how?"
"I think some professors are concerned about you graduating."
Graduation from residency required two things: meeting a set of national and local requirements, which I'd already done, and the blessing of the faculty.
"What?" I said.
"I don't mean to sound cocky, but I'm a good surgeon, just as good as..."
"I know.
I think they probably just want to see you performing the full load of a chief. It's because they like you. Seriously." I realized it was true. For the past few months, I had been acting merely as a surgical technician. I had been using cancer as an excuse not to take full responsibility for my patients. On the other hand, it was a good excuse, damn it. But now I started coming in earlier, staying later, fully caring for the patients again, adding another 4 hours to a 12-hour day. It put the patients back in the center of my mind at all times. The first 2 days I thought I would have to quit, battling waves of nausea, pain, and fatigue, retreating to an unused bed in down moments to sleep. But by the third day, I had begun to enjoy it again, despite the wreck of my body. Reconnecting with patients brought back the meaning of this work. I took antiemetics and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, between cases and just before rounds. I was suffering, but I was fully back. Instead of finding an unused bed, I started resting on the junior resident's couch, supervising them on the care of my patients, lecturing as I rode a wave of back spasms. The more tortured my body became, the more I relished having done the work. At the end of the first week, I slept for 40 hours straight. But I was calling the shots. "Hey, boss," I said. "I was just reviewing cases for tomorrow, and I know the first case is booked interhemispheric, but I think it will be much safer and easier if we come parietal transcortical."
"Really?" the attending said. "Let me look at the films."
"You know what? You're right. Can you change the booking?"
The next day. "Hi, sir, it's Paul. I just saw Mr. F. and his family in the ICU. I think we'll need to take him tomorrow for an ACDF. Okay if I book it?" When are you free?
And I was back to full speed in the OR.
Nurse, can you page Dr. S? I'm going to be done with this case before he gets here.
I've got him on the phone. He says you can't possibly be done yet.
The attending came running in, out of breath, scrubbed, and peered through the microscope.
I took a slightly acute angle to avoid the sinus, I said, but the whole tumor's out.
You avoided the sinus?
Yes, sir.
You got it out in one piece?
Yes, sir. It's on the table so you can have a look.
Looks good. Really good. When did you get to be so fast? Sorry I wasn't here earlier.
No trouble.
A tricky part of illness is that, as you go through it, your values are constantly changing. You try to figure out what matters to you, and then you keep figuring it out. It felt like someone had taken away my credit card, and I was having to learn how to budget. You may decide you want to spend your time working as a neurosurgeon, but 2 months later, you may feel differently. 2 months after that, you may want to learn to play the saxophone or devote yourself to the church. Death may be a one-time event, but living with terminal illness is a process. It struck me that I had traversed the 5 stages of grief, the denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance cliché, but I had done it all backward. On diagnosis, I'd been prepared for death. I'd even felt good about it. I'd accepted it. I'd been ready. Then I slumped into a depression, as it became clear that I might not be dying so soon after all, which is, of course, good news, but also confusing and strangely enervating. The rapidity of the cancer science and the nature of the statistics meant I might live another 12 months or another 120. Grand illnesses are supposed to be life-clarifying. Instead, I knew I was going to die, but I'd known that before. My state of knowledge was the same, but my ability to make lunch plans had been shot to hell. The way forward would seem obvious if only I knew how many months or years I had left. Tell me 3 months, I'd spend time with family. Tell me 1 year, I'd write a book. Give me 10 years, I'd get back to treating diseases. The truth that you live one day at a time didn't help. What was I supposed to do with that day? At some point, then, I began to do a little bargaining. Or, not exactly bargaining. More like, God, I have read Job, and I don't understand it, but if this is a test of faith, you now realize my faith is fairly weak, and probably leaving the spicy mustard off the pastrami sandwich would have also tested it? You didn't have to go nuclear on me, you know? Then, after the bargaining, came flashes of anger. I work my whole life to get to this point, and then you give me cancer? And now, finally, maybe I had arrived at denial. Maybe total denial. Maybe in the absence of any certainty, we should just assume that we're going to live a long time. Maybe that's the only way forward. I was operating until late at night or early into the morning, fixated on graduation, my diagnosis 9 months in the past. My body was taking a beating. I was too tired to eat when I got home. I had been slowly upping the dose of Tylenol and NSAIDs and antiemetics. I had developed a persistent cough, presumably caused by scarring from the dead tumor in my lungs. I only had to keep up this relentless pace for a couple more months, I told myself, and then I would graduate from residency and settle into the comparatively calmer role of a professor. In February, I flew to Wisconsin for a job interview. They were offering everything I wanted. Millions of dollars to start a neuroscience lab, head of my own clinical service, flexibility if I needed it for my health, a tenure-track professorship, appealing job options for Lucy, high salary, beautiful scenery, idyllic town, the perfect boss. I understand about your health, and you probably have a strong connection with your oncologist, the department chairman told me. So if you want to keep your care there, we can fly you back and forth, though we do have a top-notch cancer center here if you want to explore it. Is there anything else I can do to make this job more attractive? I thought about what Emma had told me. I had gone